decline or progress in intellectual two rabbinic intellectual histories of Torah. So we're going to start by saying that probably most of you who grew up in Orthodox backgrounds listened to a whole series of Musar Shmuzes, the subject of which is that we are not on the level of the people who preceded us. Right, for beginning, for example, Im Rishonim Kemalachim Anachnu Kivnei Adam, Vim Rishonim Kivnei Adam Anachnu Kechamorim. Right, if our predecessors were like angels, then we are like human beings. If our predecessors were like human beings, then we are like donkeys. Right, and that's supposed to give us an appropriate sense of humility with regard to our predecessors. What is often not spoken about there is that that line is followed by a very funny line. Anybody know what the funny line that follows is? Right, if they're like human beings, we're like donkeys, and? Right, so Mr. Schmitz usually leave out the end of it because the comic relief usually gets left out. But the line after it is, and not like that donkey, and then they proceed to tell a story about a particular donkey, which had a particularly high spiritual intuition, which in fact it would be a very impressive madriga to be able to walk over to Maaser food and know immediately whether Maaser had been taken from it or not. It's a Gemara in Shabbos, I believe. Okay, that's an example. One of the issues is that there are a lot of jokes in Chazal that we don't get because we're too frum. And therefore, there are a lot of times people say things that are supposed to be funny, but he couldn't possibly have meant that. Happened to me a lot when I was rabbi here. People never understood I was joking. But I want to use that not because it's a joke in a serious vein. Right, you're supposed to think, if they were Bnei Adam, then we're Chamorim. But you're not supposed to take it so seriously that you then wander around and instead of, as a religious activity, trying to contemplate words of Torah, you eat hay. Right, that's not what you're supposed to do, right? You're still supposed to conceive of yourself as a human being who has something to contribute. And it's very difficult to conceive of yourself as a human being who has something to contribute if you think of yourself as completely incapable of approaching the level of your predecessors. Now this issue, this issue of, on the one hand, trying to maintain healthy self-esteem, and on the other hand, trying to maintain an appropriate sense of reverence, is not only a problem for us, it's been a problem, right, it's a problem for anybody, you know, in a traditional religion, and in our religion, right, so you start out with Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Moshe, right, and after that, so that you can just think of yourself as nothing and never have anything to contribute. And that might be the appropriate attitude, except that we happily have been blessed with a lot of really bright people in our tradition. And not only that, a lot of really bright people who were aware that they were really bright people. And when you're aware that you're a really bright person, that tends to be good for self-esteem, not good for reverence. Right? And so one of the issues that you have to address as part of the Masoret is, how do I deal with, on the one hand, the claim that I am, right, that everyone before me was greater than I? On the other hand, I really feel like I'm a bright person. And not only that, you can even be a bright person with enough of a sense of self-esteem to say, I am saying things that have not been said previously. And you might even go so far as to say, not only am I saying specific things that have not been said previously, but I am accomplishing things methodologically that have not been accomplished before. And you might even, if you're, let's say, you know, a 17th or 18th century figure, say, you know what, I'm doing things that are so beautiful and so complicated, and I look at the Gemara, and that doesn't quite seem to be on my intellectual level. Right, if you look at, right, if you are, let's say, the author of the Shev Shmaitasa, right, the Ksos, and you've written the Shev Shmaitasa, and you look at it yourself, and you say, wow, I'm smart. And you would be legitimate, because if you look at the Shev Shmaitasa, Shev Shmaitasa is one of the great intellectual accomplishments of all time to me. If you look at it, you know, it's a work in which somebody keeps, you know, a juggler who can keep, you know, 12 or 15 balls in the air at the same time. So intellectually, that's what he does. You know, he has an amazing number of texts in the air, and he keeps on, you know, and you do this, so that text right there, and once in a while a ball falls, you don't really care. It's really impressive that somebody can keep a dozen balls in the air at the same time, most of the time. And you read the Shev Shmaitasa, and then you go back and you look at Gemara, and Gemara is just not as sophisticated. It's really not. And you have to figure out, well, how do I deal with this? Because I revere my predecessors. I accept their authority as law. And at the same time, I look at what I'm doing, and what I'm doing is a lot more sophisticated than what they were doing. Okay, so we're going to do tonight are two rabbinic approaches to this problem. How is it that on the one hand I can maintain my awe for the predecessors, while at the same time acknowledging what seems to me the honest truth, which is that I am making intellectual contributions, right? Not only that specifically that they didn't make, not only that they left me makom hinichel ravatenu litgaderbo, they left me places where a detail here, a detail there I could put in, but I am doing things intellectually that they never did, and so far as I can tell, they might not have been capable of. Right? How does that square with them being, right, with if their angels were human beings, if their human beings were donkeys? Okay, so the two approaches we're going to deal with, one is the Ksos, right, in his introduction to this work, the Shev Shemaitasa, and the second is a work that we're all going to do in great excerpt, which is the introduction of the Nitziv, Rav Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, to his monumental Ha'amek She'ilah, his commentary on the She'iltot Rav Chai Gaon. We're going to do several paragraphs in what is like a 40-page introduction, which is one of the great rabbinic works of art of the last two centuries. So if you like what you see, I hope you'll get a chance to read the whole thing, because it's an absolutely glorious piece, literarily, not to mention intellectually. You'll get a taste of the intellectual. I can't really give you a taste of the style. Just my own personal testimonial, I tend to be the kind of person who doesn't like taking notes and who doesn't like being derivative. I went through this line by line, summarizing every page, etc. It's really, really gorgeous. I can tell you, I really relate to it. Okay, so let's start with the Shev Shemaitza. So the introduction to Shev Shemaitza, page 1, begins by saying, Hagam sheyesh ben adam shemukhrachin lasot eze mischar. Rachmana litzlan, there are some people who are compelled to engage in business rather than learn Torah all their time. Right, so if you are among those people who are compelled to engage in business, then tzaricha masal matan liyot b'emuna, then you have to engage in business honestly, and he tells you that that's the way in which your judgment after heaven starts, and he has a whole discussion about that, which we don't have time to go into. Paragraph 2. Right, after we go through the discussion of whether if you were in fact compelled to engage in business, you engage in business honestly, so then we say, oh, chorli noto, the second question they ask you after death is, pilpalta b'chachma. Okay, have you engaged in pilpul? Now, you should be aware that pilpul is a word that changes meaning over time. Pilpul sometimes is described what you do, which is good, or it can be described what other people do, which is pilpul shel hevel, as opposed to what you do is good. It has technical meanings in various historical stages. Let's just define pilpul as whatever the most advanced mode, intellectually advanced mode of Talmudic reasoning is, in any particular era. Okay, so when you go up to Shemayim, they ask you, have you in fact engaged in Talmud at the intellectual level that you should have? Okay, and Mavur, the Chavad Alavavot, Shar HaChishbon. So if you look in Chavad Alavavot, it tells you, Sheyachshovim nafsho bit acharam hevin sefer Torat Elokim, you should have the cheshbon ha-nefesh. You should have the self-evaluation. Every time you fail to understand something in Torah, that should set off a spiritual crisis, or at least a spiritual self-examination. Why? Right? Because any time that you fail to understand something, and you can go on, then there's something wrong with you. Right, then we go to the royal metaphor, right? If there were a king and he sent you a message, would you ever stop? Would you do anything other than try and figure out what did this message say? What did this message say? So if you can go to sleep, if there's a sugya you haven't figured out yet, there's something wrong with you spiritually. That's claim one. I don't know how many of you have had this experience. I had this with one sugya. The first sugya in the eighth chapter of Yoma kept me awake for years and years and years. I won't teach that to you tonight. But I always used to wonder, like, why it was anybody in the from world could sleep when that sugya existed. I used to go over to Rosh Yeshiva and say, what is shot in that line over there? And they would tell me what they thought, and I would explain why it was wrong. And I just kept waiting for this clinical reports about a wave of insomnia sweeping through Yeshiva. It doesn't happen that much. Because there are, my favorite scholarly piece I love is on the impact of coffee on halakhic culture. You can trace where that did actually once, and the impact of coffee on halakhic culture is Tikkun Chatzot. Right? You can trace, apparently, right? Tikkun Chatzot spreads immediately after coffee comes into a culture. Right? All of a sudden, people are staying up till midnight. right, and morning debate the mikdash. So I thought this sugi would have the same effect, but no. Okay, so you should write, right, the raft, the ellipsis, he says, "Mizeh yitarir adam Yisrael, kama hu chayev l'ashiv l'ashilah niskeret, filpalta b'chachma." Okay, and that, so from this we should be inspired to realize what the standard is to answer the question in Shemayim, have you engaged in Torah to the necessary intellectual level? Okay, below the istapek bipshutut, and you shouldn't just understand text of Torah simply. Okay, but now he comes to the statement that will look radical. Ella, however, the hakadmonim, but our predecessors, the early ones, the yosher sichlam ha'amiti, because of their straightforward, truthful intellect, lo hayutzrichim kol kach omke pilpul, kasher anachnu po hayom. Right, even though he's just decided that pilpul is this critical element, but you have to understand that our predecessors didn't need it to the extent we do, the extent that we do, because they had more straightforward intellects. Okay, but filu b'mei amoraim amru anan ke'etzva b'kira b'kira lisvara mikol shekain anan yasmi diyasmi kama nitzrachim zman zmanim lohavin svara achas mikadonenu zikron livracha lozet zerech pilpul rav. Okay, so right now it's pretty clear we're still in humble reverent mode. Right, they were so much clearer than we were. They didn't need the kind of pilpul we do. Okay, but then he goes on to say, "Okay, umaral mal moshnido biviral sef kohelet yakarb michachma umichavod sichlut meat." But if we go into this commentary on Kohelet, the verse says that that a little bit of foolishness is more precious than a great deal of wisdom. Now, why is foolishness more precious than wisdom? And Ayin Sham, because he wrote, "The Hayisharim b'sichlam einam charifim kol kach." Those people who have really straightforward intellects aren't as sharp. V'acharifut einu ela agav shebeshta. And intellectual acuity is a byproduct of intellectual confusion. No confusion, no acuity. V'lefi she'elu she'ein sichlam yashar, and because those who don't have naturally straight intellects, and they have some kind of blockage in their minds, if you can overcome this block, then your intellect ascends to as previously unreached heights. And the fire burns with even greater power. His metaphor is, I don't know if this is true physically or not, that if you have a flame, you drop a little bit of water on it, the flame shoots up. Right? So that's what an intellect that isn't straightforward does.
Fire will do that.
Sometimes fire will do that. Pardon?
It's a grease fire
will do that. Okay. So thought is like a grease fire. Right? We have our new our metaphor. Kena davar hazeh im yesh lo seichel ksat minaged v'hu asichlut me'at v'az yitgaber alav haseichel v'yeh mechudad yoter v'yoter. Okay, and he says on the basis of this, we can explain, this is the last paragraph, what Chazal said, v'hinei tov me'od, very good, that's the Yetzer Tov, very good, that's the Yetzer Hara. Why? Because the Yetzer Hara is called a fool. And foolishness is even better than the Yetzer Tov, which is wise. Because your intellect reaches greater heights in the presence of foolishness than it would if it were simply straightforward. Okay, so the Shemesh Maitzah comes to the conclusion, therefore, that we can explain why it is that the Shemesh Maitzah is intellectually so much more powerful than the Gemara, on the grounds that the people in the Gemara had straightforward intellects, and therefore their intellectual muscles never developed. Right, because muscles, right, take my metaphor, right, muscles only develop, right, when there's tension, or something they're pushing against. Now, he doesn't explain to you, why it is that if our intellect is in fact sharper, why it is we remain subservient to those people who had more straightforward intellects, if in fact, right, our fire burns stronger and higher. Right, and that I leave as a problem. But he does make the clear claim, right, that intellectually we are in fact in a superior position to our predecessors, and we have to figure out for yourself, right, how that relates to authority. I suspect that the language of his claim has affinities to the Rashbam's notion, right, the Rishonam mitoch Chasidusam, lo his askel kol kach bipshuto shel mikra. Rashbam is a similar issue. Why is it that I seem to be better at pshat than the Gemara? And the answer is because they were firmer than me, so they didn't have, right, they didn't engage in pshat quite so much. No one's quite figured out exactly, I think, what he meant by that either. Right, but it gives you a genre of response to a feeling that you're accomplishing things intellectually that your revered predecessors can't, that somehow they were prevented by their, right, by their piety, right, or in his case, by their absolute clarity from actually developing. Okay, so there's one source, right, in which the history, the intellectual history of Torah is not one, as Rabbi Lam felicitously called it, right, a degeneration theory, right, but rather, right, Yiridat HaDorot, right, literally, but rather is one in which, as a result of some form of decline in our natural clarity, the intellectual history of Torah is one, in fact, of constant improvement. Okay, right, we'll have to figure out according to that,
why it is that we haven't produced anything equal to the Xos in our current generation. Perhaps it is that we've had a revival of intellectual clarity, such that our intellects don't need to reach the Xos of Madriga.
Nonetheless, it gives you a warrant for saying that there are things you can contribute that are not simply attempts to recreate the past, but you can actually contribute things that have not been previously contributed. Okay. So much for the Ksot, who doesn't have that broad an agenda. He's really just writing an apology for a book which he understands probably reaches a new level of intellectual acuity using a methodology that hadn't previously existed. So he has to explain where this book is coming from. The Netziv has a broader agenda, because he's justifying his book not in those terms. He's actually writing a justification of a different book. All right, the Netziv is writing a commentary on the Shi'iltot de Rava Chai Gaon, which is a Gaonic work. And before the Netziv, he correctly has the sense, so the Gaonim were those people who existed between the Gemara and the Rishonim. Right, the Gaonim didn't really have such cachet. Those of us who grew up in the YU world, so people used to love quoting the Rav, saying, my grandfather could learn better than some of those Gaonim. Right, so somehow, you read a Sadoros, right, that whole system, right, if you were graphing the way it worked, it goes Tanaim, Amoraim, Geonim, Rishonim. Achronim, Achronim, Achronim. Geonim just, didn't get no respect. So the Tzim was doing a fairly radical thing in writing this massive commentary on a Geonic work. And a very, very peculiar Geonic work in that regard, which legitimately often looks like a simplified version of the Gemara as opposed to an advance. For reasons that we don't need to talk about now. Okay, but the Netziv's overall agenda here in this work, right, is going to be to try and explain why it is necessary for him to write a commentary on the Gaonim. But it takes 40 pages to get there, and along the way he develops a whole series of really critical concepts about the development of halakha. And also, again, with unbelievable sense of style and literature. I'm going to throw in just one more excursus, that there is a quote from the Torah Tmima, which is often used as a quote in favor of the beauty of a lifestyle which is constricted entirely to the formal study of Torah, which he says, that the maskilim used to come talk to the Netziv, and they would be astounded. How could somebody who just learned Talmud end up with such a gorgeous sense of style? Because they thought only maskilim could write Hebrew, and they come talk or speak Hebrew, and they come to Netziv, and they'd just be overwhelmed by the right, by the beauty of his Hebrew. And so this, the Torah Tmeva's telling, this appears to be, it's a look, hafochba vafochba the kulaba, right? You can spend your day learning Talmud and still come out a magnificent Hebrew stylist.
First, he himself wasn't one to.
So in the introduction to the Netziv's commentary on Chumash, he tells you that the difference between biblical poetry and biblical prose should be as clear to you as the difference in style between Yehuda Halevi and Shlomo Ibn Gabirol. Right? So it's really sort of a very good sense of style. I'm perfectly happy saying that Ibn Gabirol and Yehuda and Halevi are Torah, but it's not Talmud. Right? This is somebody with a very clear sense of beauty, right? And how beauty of style plays a role right, plays itself a role in Torah, and so it's not surprising that his introduction here is just an absolute, really magnificent work of art. Okay, so let's start. Right, Hakdamat HaMek Shela begins. Ve'et ata kadosh baruch hu mirivavot kodesh, uvimino esh das lamo. Right, so we're playing off the of Zota Bracha. Right, so when God comes, whatever Rivot Kodesh is, and the organizing metaphor for the entire introduction is Eish Das Lamo. Eish Das, you know, is this peculiar thing. Is it one word or two? Right, we have this whole issue as to how we do it in Chumash. But the Tziv takes this Eish Das, right, which is describing Torah, right, because it's what's in God's right hand when he comes to Sinai, and he says it tells you that the two essential characteristics of Torah are Eish and Das. And Torah is some combination of the two. What do Eish and Das stand for? Nichlal b'zeh ha-Torah shnei chalkei ha-Torah, chelek ha-mavur lakol, v'hem adinim chatuchim l'das ma l'asos v'lo ya'avor, v'zeh nikra dat. Okay, so one is the exoteric Torah, the Torah which is evident, which can be understood by everybody, which is what to do, law. Right? So Das, he says, is law. And that's one part of Torah. But there's also a chelek mechusa. There's also an esoteric part. Ad sheyavola chakira vehekeshim ad sheyetze l'or. Until one comes to engage in intellectual analysis so that one brings it to light. Vezehu esh. Okay, and this is fire. Okay, so our two organizing metaphors are the law, straightforward, and the parts of Torah that can only be revealed through analysis, which is fire. And he tells you the first part of that metaphor is shehu mitchalek l'kam anitzotzot. Right, fire divides, right, can give off sparks. Okay, one of the characteristics of Eish is that every part of Eish can generate its own fire. Right, so Torah can expand because it's not right because the thing about a fire is that a fire is not limited to its original size. Any element of fire, if it finds fuel somewhere else, can build yet larger and larger fires. Right, so the intellectual analysis of Torah causes Torah to grow, as opposed to law, which just stays the way it is. Okay, that's argument number one. Okay, now we go into history. It says, Meirosh Mikedem, Mimoti Yoshua Ba'elech, from the very beginning, from the days of Yoshua and on, Nafal Sveikot Asherbo Nechluku Gedolei Hador. There were always doubts about which the grace of the generation differed. V'nimnu V'gamru Al Pidas Rabim, Kimefurish B'Torah, V'az Nikra Halucha Brura, V'na'aseh Deit Dat Me'esh. Okay, so his claim is that the Torah never existed as perfect clarity in which everything was understood. From the very beginning, from the time of Yehoshua, right after, at least after the death of Moshe Rabbeinu, there were always doubts, and those doubts always had to be resolved by vote. Okay, now how do you resolve these doubts? You have to talk about them. Okay, so what happens there is, you talk about it, you engage in analysis, and the result of the analysis is you come out with clear law. And what that tells you is that Das and Eish are not distinct categories, but they are kind of like energy and mass, right? Things can, right? One can be transformed into the other, right? So the process of, right, taking a doubt, analyzing it, and then producing new law is the process of transforming Eish into Das. And he tells you that, by the way, that's by this I don't have the original quote takes too long for you. He tells you that Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai doesn't necessarily mean that God orally told Moses something at Sinai. It refers to any of the laws that were decided in this fashion in those days, any das that goes back to ancient times. And he tells you furthermore, right, which is very important for understanding law in general, that it is not the will of God that all Eish turn into das, that there are areas in Torah which are supposed to remain Eish rather than dust, that they're not supposed to be fixed as law. And that's going to be a critical idea going all the way through, that the goal, and he says there's even a position which says the goal in most of Torah, some people say the goal is only in a part of Torah, is to leave Torah sufficiently undefined that people can make different decisions. Right? The goal is not to turn all of Torah into dust so that everybody can know exactly what to do, and what everyone will do is exactly the same. Some parts of Torah are supposed to be left in Koei. Okay, take that for now. So now he sets up second organizing metaphor, this is the second paragraph, which is there's Eish and Das, and then there are people who specialize in each. Right? He defines the people who specialize in Das are Shevet Levi, and the people who specialize in Esh are Das is Shevet Levi, and Esh is Shevet Yehuda. Okay, so he says, "V'nektiv b'Shevet Levi yoru mishpatech liYaakov, uviyudak ktiv mechokek mibein raglav." Okay, so now it turns out that Levi does hora'a, and Yehuda does chakika. Now, what do those terms mean? So hora'a for him means making actual decisions in specific cases. Whereas a chok for him, and this, if you see Nitziv's commentary in Chumash, you'll see that while you've probably learned all the right from Rashi that a mishpat is a law that's readily comprehensible, and a chok is a law that takes is a law that's incomprehensible. Or you learn from the Spanish philosophic tradition, Rambam, that a mishpat is a law that's readily comprehensible, and a chok is a law that requires philosophy to understand. The Nitziv says that a mishpat is a specific law, and a chok is a principle from which law is derived. If he takes that principle, a chok is a principle of interpretation, whereas a mishpat is a law in a specific circumstance. Okay, so Levi specializes in hora'ah, Yehuda specializes in chakika. Okay, if hafresh bazeh is, what the difference between them is, the ikar hora'ah b'Yisrael l'maseh, that the actual practical poskim were Shevet Levi. Aval, kocham lo haya el horot lefi sha'ah. But the power that Shevet Levi had was only to issue rulings in specific cases, never to make actual law. Right? To tell you what to do in a case, not to set up a rule. Ve'en lo more el amash ein avra'ot. And a specific a posik can only judge based on what they see, not on abstractions. Right? So the when we say ena dayan dan elamash einavroot, the point is that judges in specific cases have to be in the specific case. They have to look at what they see, right? As opposed to making a decision on the basis of an abstraction, which is unrelated to what's in front of them. Okay. Right. So therefore, v'siyata d'shmaya mechavne halacha. So with God's help, they would get the law right in the specific case of a lokavi halacha l'dorot, but they would never establish fixed law that would apply beyond their case to future generations. La'achriach she'efshar lozuz mi'ota ha'hura'ah. So they could never make permanent law. You could always rule differently in the next case, right? If all you had was Shevet Levi, you would have no precedent. Right? All you would have, every case would be judged from scratch. Okay. Baval Shevi Yehuda lehefech, right? But Yehuda does the reverse. Shikul datam lohavi masliach lechaveneh emet. Their intellectual capacity did not enable them to achieve truth. Aval zekocham lohotzi lahamtiach reot al pi chakira upilpul ad sheyetzei leor dinim mechutachim sheyefshar od lozuz imena. But by engaging in analysis, they wouldn't necessarily know what to do in a specific case, but they could emerge with principles that were fixed for all generations. That's his organizing metaphor number two. And then he gives you a whole history, which we don't have time to go through, which he shows you how there are periods. Right, Shlomo HaMelech is the great rise of intellectual acuity, where there's this tremendous upsurge of Esh, and out of that Esh comes a tremendous amount of Das. And then pretty much for the rest of Bayit Rishon, everybody just works off what Shlomo did. Nobody feels a need to engage in any analysis. The law was clear enough that basically there was no business for intellectuals in Torah until you get to Yoshio, and Yoshio understands that the spiritual intuition of Shevet Levi, right, which is symbolized by the kahuna and the mikdash, right, that's why it's Levi, right, because it's a spiritual intuition, is going to vanish when the base of mikdash is destroyed. So that's why Yoshio puts in this educational system, because all of a sudden we're going to need analysis again, because we're not going to have intuitive poskim. Okay, and then the Atrikanis Zagdola come along and they say, which means you can't just come to conclusions intuitively, you have to really think about it. He sets up this whole intellectual history. Then you have the real explosion, which takes place with the Talmud Bavli. When we're in exile again. Right? So we're in exile, we don't have any spiritual intuition at all. So first of all, he says, the reason the Bavli is more complicated than the Yerushalmi is because at least the Yerushalmi is in Eretz Yisrael. There's some remnants of spiritual intuition. But in Bavel, there's nothing at all. In Bavel, they're thrown entirely on on the resources of their intellects, and therefore it turns out that the Bavli, in his estimation, is a much more complicated intellectual work than the Yerushalmi. Okay, but so far, we're just dealing with these as parallel tracks. The Bavli and Yerushalmi, for the first time, gives you a situation in which you have to compare authority. Right? Up till now, everybody's working hand in hand. Right? Yehuda engages in analysis, comes out with principles, and then how to figure out how those principles apply in real life, you go back to the Levi. But the Yerushalmi and the Bavli are competing. And now we have to start evaluating if you have to choose between the specialist in Psak and the specialist in Pilpul. Right? How do you choose? Okay, so he says, right? So he says that in fact he rereads he reads Reb Yirmiya, that famous line, "B'machashakim hashivani kimosei olam." That's Bavel. God left me in darkness, not because it's a bad thing, but in darkness you build fires. Right? So Talmud Bavel succeeds. Okay, so you look at the. Take a look, right, we're in the third paragraph on the second page on Mekshila. He says, "Uchushinistam Talmud Bavli osuoto lefaltarin gadol v'nara." When the Talmud Bavli was finished, they made it this great palace. "V'hagaonim shabau acharei chachmei Bavel mechabrei haTalmud yudu kama shvilei pshutim b'zeh hapaltarin asher lo nistapku b'halichus ela halachos me'olam v'zeh garam shlo hishtam shahar be." He says, now, the Bavli is this tremendous intellectual edifice. And you have to try and see if you can know your way around this or not. So the Gaonim, he claims, right, the Gaonim, again, who aren't these intellectually complicated people, right, the Gaonim have the map to the Talmud. So they don't have to engage in all sorts of complicated schemes to break through the doors and understand it. They just have these back doors everywhere. So the Gaonim go back to this intuitive mode. Right, they understand the Talmud simply, and therefore they don't need to engage intellectual analysis. However, he says, "Vashem chepet leman tzidko," the God who, right, God has his own desires. "L'shanein barak charbash al Torah," right? God wished to sharpen the sword of Torah. Right, sharpen the flash of the sword of Torah. Therefore, galak vod ha Torah mi bavel imdinat tzarfat eretz lo ra'u or hakabalah sudurah. So God deliberately caused the Torah society to be exiled from Babylonia, where the Gaonim were, where they still remembered everything, and they didn't have to, right, they had no doubts, they didn't have to use their intellects. So God sent Torah to the wilds of France, where there was no tradition. And the only way you could read Talmud was by thinking about it, not because you knew what it was, not because you had a tradition. Right, so what happens? V'hutruchu limso petach ha-paltirin al-pi'yun v'chikira. So there, where they didn't have the light of an ordered tradition, and therefore they had to find the entrance to the palace through investigation and analysis. Yagu matush fil chadash kechamabara. So they made the effort and they found a new path that was as bright as the sun. Loshimshu laora ein gaon kadmon ravamora. Right, which a path with a light that no previous gaon or any previous posek had ever used its light. And from light, from darkness and fog, right, they produced a great fire of God. Okay, and then obviously, right, Shalhevet Ka comes from Shir HaShirim. Okay, so Uchtiv beKohelet Zayin Yud. So Kohelet says, Al Tomar Mehaya Shehayamim Harishonim Hayu Tovim Me'ele. Okay, so never say. Right, he quotes Kohelet as saying, never say, what happened? Previous generations were greater than we are. Right, you're not ever supposed to say that, despite all those Gemaras. Right, you're not ever supposed to say what happened, right, because the earlier days were better than these. He's here a Chacham Baruch HaKodesh. Right, so what's that talking about? So with a prophetic insight, Shlomo HaMelech tells you that there are going to be people who come along and make fun of Pilpul. And they're going to say, how can Pilpul be true? Right, once upon a time we can understand all these things simply. Right, how can it be true that we need to engage in all these intellectual endeavors which haven't happened before? Right, so he's here a chacham beruach hakodesh et amalegim b'derech b'mechudash hu derech apilpul. Right, so Shlomo HaMelech was telling you with something close to nevuah that someday people will come along with previously untrodden intellectual paths, and other people will make fun of them for being new. Don't think that. Right, new methodologies are entirely legitimate. They may be necessary. And this, you know, the debate against Topol, I know that there's a particular Sephardi Rosh Hashiva NYU who used to enjoy coming over to us when we read the Ksos and saying, Ashkenazim mevalbelim et hamoach, right? Ashkenazim would just confuse the intellect, right? You should learn Sephardim and just do it straightforwardly, right? None of this complicated, right? None of these, right, distorting intellectual paths. So that debate still goes on. So he thinks that the Kohelet was against this, right? That the fact that intellectual path is more complicated and doesn't seem to be approaching the truth directly doesn't mean that it's illegitimate. Okay, now he says, I hear that it seems, you know, it's pretty strong language, very reverent strong language. He says, Yodu chachmei tosfot et ma'alat ha-geonim sharu or ha-kabbalah. The, right, the Baalei Tosfot knew the greatness of the geonim who still saw the light of the tradition. V'chamat pa'amim nachtu gam heima b'pnei k'dushat divreihem shel geonim v'yamru shehem divrei kabbalah. And every once in a while, the Baalei Tosfot would say, you know what? Doesn't make sense to us, but the Gaonim said it, they had the tradition, they're greater than us. Okay, so the Baalei Tosfot had this element of reverence. However, it says, Amnam, Meirov hergilam lamod al hakira. Because the Baalei Tosfot were habituated to thinking analytically instead of to simply accepting received tradition, Libam lo nachonimam bechleit gemura, v'lo natnu imun b'chol devar shlamatu at hapetach v'ha'ora. So they were incapable, really, of just saying, okay, that's a tradition, we buy it as is. Right? They were their characters had developed to the point where they couldn't learn Torah that way by just saying it's a tradition, we accept it. Therefore, he said, therefore, Gam Orayinu Rambanzal, Asher Mastar Nafshol Divrei HaGaonim V'chol Kocho Amal V'yashvam, B'mash Einam B'divreihem Kol Kach Mufurash, Haya Mateh Divrei HaGaonim L'Dato Agdola. Right? He says in the Ramban, who wrote his work Milchamot Hashem to defend the Rif, whom the Netziv sees as the direct descendant of the Geonim, right? So the Ramban wrote the Milchamot to defend the Rif. He says even the Ramban, who is Moser Nefesh, right, who gives over, you know, tremendous amounts of intellectual effort to defend the Geonim, when it comes down to it, if they didn't write really explicitly what they said, the way he defended them was by making them say what the Tosafists said, right? Because he couldn't really deal with the way they thought. But he says, Lochein Rishon lo ra'aha Rambam Zal or Hagola. But Maimonides, right, was the one figure who was still capable of thinking the way the Gaonim did. V'inei Rabotenu Achronim Zal hibitu acharei Moshe hu Rambam Zal b'ayin yafeh uv'chol chepet ratzu la'amod al da'to v'chol makom sh'nisgeva halichotav mishitat ha'sugya kefi ha'murgal niperish rashi v'tosfet v'shita ha'mekubetzet. And all the Achronim, right, really, because of their dedication to the Rambam, every time the Rambam seemed to read the sugya differently than Rashi and Tosfot, they would say, gee, how could the Rambam read the sugya differently than Rashi and Tosfot? It's a problem. So what would they do? Al-kein matzu atzmam mechuyavim la'tot da'ato al-pi diktukim v'havayot im'at im'harbe kefi kol choshal ha'me'ayen. Right, he says that anybody, if you look at what the Achronim do to the Rambam, what they do is they read, right, right, they find themselves obligated to twist the Rambam through really close readings and all sorts of questions and things like that, so that they can get the Rambam to mean the same thing as Tosfot, right? Because they can't conceive of a way of reading Gemara which is different than the way the Tosafists did. However, here this is very strong language. He says, "V'chol sheyesh lo moach b'kad kado." Anybody who has a brain in their head. Vidat yeshara hodov v'hadro, and a straightforward intellect is his glory, right? Is his glory and his honor. Yodeh will concede ki lo achal piachreach habam mipilpulim gaon hora. Ki lo piachreach habam mipilpulim, because it's not through a proof that comes through all this intellectual acuity. Yasur gaon hora yasur achor mi mislolim. That no posig is ever going to change, right, what they do because you have a cool argument. And therefore, all these Achronim misunderstand the Rambam because they think the Rambam needs to learn Gemara the way the Tosafists did. And really, the truth is, in order to understand the Rambam, you have to forget Rashi, you have to forget Tosafot, you have to forget all of France, which is a product of this confusion that arose because God deliberately exiled Torah to France so that we could come up with these new methodologies. But if you want to understand the Rambam, you got to go back to the Gaonim. Because the Rambam reads Sugyot without any of this intellectual baggage. He just reads the words the way they are, and he has this straightforward intellect. Okay, right. So here again, the Netziv, you have a very explicit claim that Torah, that the intellectual history of Torah is progress, not decline. Although progress intellectually is a result of loss of intuition. And there are times when God deliberately brings about this progress by losing the intuition. But then the Netziv says in the end, "Bapsak," right? Torah grows through intellectual acuity. Abstract law grows through intellectual acuity, but psak declines. Right? Psak, which is the capacity to know what to do in a specific case, right, that goes away. Okay. So the first thing I want you to come out with just is, again, this notion that at least there are here, you have two very, very traditional figures who believed that it was legitimate and true to make the claim that the intellectual history of Torah is one of a rise as opposed to a decline. And there is no reason to believe that one is intellectually inferior to the predecessors of the tradition. Right? They are compelled to find some way in which they concede the superiority of the past, but it's not intellectual in any way. The second issue, which really comes out of the Netziv very powerfully, is that there are different modes of learning Torah, and particularly that there are three particular modes. There's what you do in analysis, there's how you transform analysis into law, and it's how you transform law into case law. And all of those are distinct disciplines. And the capacity to be great at one might not necessarily bring greatness in the other, it might actually be antithetical to greatness in the other. Right? Because the capacity to paskin specific cases might be specifically because you're not led astray by abstractions. And the capacity to think abstractly develops because you can't intuit what to do. Right, so I want to think about how that affects your own Talmud Torah as well, and then just to finish with the discussion of the program, what we do in the summer, a large measure, among other things, is A, to try and bring people face-to-face with the differences in methodology between learning and psak, and to try and make people understand what the connections are between what they say in a Beit Midrash, and how halacha actually develops. To realize that halacha, that those are distinct disciplines, but yet they affect each other, and to take responsibility for the impact of all of these in all areas. Secondly, to realize that there is warrant in the tradition for saying that every generation has something unique to add, and that God deliberately exiles Torah to new situations so that we can find something new to contribute. I myself am a strong believer that it's Yata Dishmaya that God exiled Torah to America, so that not necessarily for particular methodological implications in terms of Talmud Torah, but because there's an exposure to certain concepts of the way in which human beings ought to relate to each other politically and societally, particularly in terms of democracy and issues like that, which I think Torah is greatly enriched by their integration. And I'm perfectly happy that Netziv thought we went to France so we could develop Pilpul to say that we went to America so that we could develop the democratic theory of halachic state. What I do in the summer is to ask you to confront all these issues, how who you are as an American relates to who you are as a Talmud Chacham, how who you are in the Beit Midrash when you're engaged in all these abstractions, how that relates to what you think ought to become law, and how what you think ought to become law relates to what you think a specific person ought to do. You can think of concrete cases yourself where that comes up. One of the cases in which this comes up most clearly in America are the numerous people who believe that abortion should be illegal except when confronted by specific cases in their family, which may very well be legitimate. May very well be that the idea is that there should be a law on the books which should be possible to evade. So I try and make you think about all those issues. I hope that a lot of you will consider coming to learn with me this summer. If you have interest in talking with me afterwards, I guess I'll be outside the Beit Midrash when the next speaker comes. My email address is on the materials. You can find it on the website, again, summerbeitmidrash.org. And if you're just interested or challenged by the ideas I said here, and even though you don't want to come learn, you just feel like having the conversation, that would be great too.